Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Holo is here to help. Holo is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Holo has something for everyone. Holo is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.holo.app/breadbox.
Here he comes. Here he comes.
If the feeling's kind of low about the dues you've been paying.
Okay, future is coming right now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio 980 in your dial. Welcome. Glad you could join us tonight. We are here. That is, we are here beneath the surface. Every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m., bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Tonight, ladies and gentle things, we delve beneath the surface on the question of heaven. What is it, and how do you get there? If there is a more important question to ask than that, I want you to give me a call at 978-454-4980. And if there isn't, I want you to give me a call at 978-454-4980 anytime within this hour so that you can join us in our conversation about the all-important topic of eternal life. Does it exist? What is it? And how do you get there? And before I introduce my guest, let me introduce Cindy behind the glass. Cindy, how are you doing this week?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Fantabulous. Have you seen any Christmas shows at all on television this season yet?
Not yet.
No? No, you know which one I saw? And it reminds me of what Tom Duggan used to call you?
Rudolph.
No, he didn't call you Rudolph. He used to call you Cindy Lou Who. Remember that?
I hate that. Don't do that.
Okay, oops, I didn't say it. Was that you, John? I didn't say it.
It weren't me.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I saw The Grinch. I saw The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. And I did not see the cartoon version. That is occurring, actually, this Saturday evening. But I did see the movie version with, do you know who starred in it?
Mr. Jim Carrey.
Yes, Jim Carrey himself. It was good. It was a good rendition of the cartoon, I thought. They did it justice. But anyway, we are here. You are there. We are both communicating because you are listening to me. And let me introduce to you the one who you've already heard, but will be joining us for the next hour. Here he is, your guest and mine, the one, the only, Mr. John Tudorus.
Hello, hello, Mr. Paul. How are you today?
Complain I can't. Yourself?
Complain not I either.
That is very good. All right, so, Mr. John, first of all, you are a man of wisdom.
Sometimes.
Yes. A truth seeker.
Not as often as I should be.
And somebody who loves the true, the good, and the beautiful.
I should hope I do more than I do now.
Well, now that we understand who you are and what your values are, do you seek to go to heaven?
I really would like to, yes.
You really would?
I really, really would, but okay. I often fall short.
Okay. So you're not a materialist. You believe that heaven exists.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, yes, indeed. The human person, this earthly life that we live on now is just sort of the beginning of life. Is that it? Sort of the jump-off points?
It's like the training wheels.
The training wheels of life. So after the grave, we experience something much greater, something much better, hopefully, and obviously something much longer since it never ends.
Yes.
All right.
But not length as far as we know it.
Okay. Let me ask you this question. If you believe that there is a life after this life on Earth, do you believe there was a life before this life on Earth?
No,
okay.
I do not. I believe this is the one-shot deal.
So then, you don't believe in what some people with Eastern philosophies might believe, that have a dualistic understanding of the human person, that souls pre-exist bodies. You don't believe that?
No. Now,
okay.
That's not to say that the creator of the soul does not know from all eternity that person.
You mean every person is in the eternal mind of God?
Exactly.
But the actual existence of a person does not precede his conception in his mother's womb. Is that fair to say?
That is correct. That's very fair to say.
Okay. So then, when God uses the human instruments as his instruments in creating the body, he simultaneously creates or infuses the human soul into the conceptus, and there we have a human person. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. At the moment of conceptus.
Say that five times fast.
All
right, never mind.
Yeah. So at the moment of conception, it's not just the physical person that starts, it's the, as far as the material part, it's actually the entire person, including the animating soul as well.
Okay. As we know, the embryo from the very beginning is animated and growing.
Correct.
Even though completely dependent on his mother's body, that doesn't mean that he's not a unique individual human being, member of the human species.
Yes, and okay. One could actually argue that at least for a few years after their birth, they're also dependent upon their mother's body as well.
Yeah, and as we continue into the 21st century, that dependence seems to get longer and longer.
Prolonged adolescence goes a long time.
All right, but anyway, the point I'm making is that this earthly life, as important as it is, begins in our conception, but you think, as a metaphor, that life in the womb is to what life outside of the womb is, that earthly life is to what heaven will be.
I would say that's a very good and fair analogy.
Yeah?
Yes, I would. I mean, so much is that when someone is in the womb, there is formation that is going on before they can actually come out of the womb.
Yes.
And of course, with all analogies, there's no perfect correlation, but it the overall general sense of it does hold.
So then you'd say that this life that we have for a few decades, maybe 8 or 9 if we're lucky, is a time of formation?
Oh yes. And, you know, it's sad as many people don't think of it that way or don't even realize that it is actually just that. The extent of their belief and their understanding of a human existence is that's it.
Yeah.
This is it. Or they may have some sense that there is an afterlife, but, you know, all dogs go to heaven. Everyone goes to heaven.
I was just about to... that was my next question. I was waiting for you to end your sentence. We seem to live simultaneously in a culture today that is an everybody gets a trophy culture and an everybody goes to heaven culture. And I kind of think they're correlated. If you go to a wake, for example,
Uncle Bob's playing golf in the sky with the angels playing their harps.
Well, no,
he's
not
getting a hole in one every time.
Not just that, but he's in a better place. or he's in heaven. It's good that he's no longer suffering because now he's at peace. All of these phrases that people use, how do they know?
They don't.
Yeah.
I mean, to some degree, we can. There's a certain trajectory.
Of a person's life, you mean?
Exactly. But the general problem with what you brought up is that many people think just because someone dies, they go to heaven. Well, what is heaven then? Just does that give you automatic entrance into heaven just because you die? Or is heaven a natural consequence of life's choices?
Yeah. And what would you say, I mean, there's the whole moral realm, of course.
Yes. What,
you know, whether you choose good or evil throughout your life, in the small choices and in the large choices. But isn't there an ultimate choice here being made as to whether you want to be in union with, have a right relationship with the Creator or not? Isn't that sort of underlying the whole thing?
Oh, it absolutely is underlying the whole thing. I mean, heaven itself isn't just a general place that people go to when they transition off of this mortal coil, just because. So, for example, maybe in ancient Greece, they had Hades, the abode of the dead, where everyone would go regardless of who you were.
Right.
So it's just another transit, another place that you might go to.
Right.
Whereas in the Judeo-Christian sense, and Judeo, not always consistent as much as on the Christian sense, that if someone actually dies, there really is only two ultimate destinations. It's part of what we call the four last things. And I think we actually did a show on that a while back.
Yep.
Where we talk about there's death, so that's the first part, and judgment, so there's a particular judgment of a soul, and then that judgment itself isn't so much God judging us, rather we present ourselves before God, who is truth, and then naturally from there, we actually place ourselves in one of two camps, and automatically, and that would either be heaven, which is union with God, or hell, which is rejection of God. So if someone in this life, for example, has no desire to be with God, and then they ultimately die, God, in his perfect love and perfect generosity and actually mercy, will not force someone to be in heaven with him, to be in that union with him, if they don't want him. It would actually be far worse for them to be put into that place with him. So he actually honors their decision and lets them go to where they actually ultimately desire to go to, which is away from him in their own place, hell.
Just like he honored Adam and Eve's choice at the beginning of humanity. Let me unpack some of what you said there. First of all, you went back to the ancient Greeks, and we can throw in a lot of ancient peoples, like the ancient Israelites with Sheol, the abode of the dead, the ancient Greeks with Hades, the river Styx. The Oriental religions with ancestor worship. There seems to be, from the beginning of mankind, a recognition, universally, doesn't matter where you live or what century you lived in, a recognition universally that there is something invisible within the human person that survives bodily death.
Oh, goodness, yes. For example, Aristotle, I think we brought this up in a few prior shows, believe the human soul to actually be immortal. So upon death, it's not, even though the material body dies, the soul itself would actually continue on as a disembodied soul.
Right, and with the ancient Greeks, they philosophically came up with a way to explain why they believe that there is a part of us that continues to live on, because the part of us that is able to have reason and free will, which rises above our physiological selves that animals don't have and that plants don't have, that's not a physiological thing. That's a spiritual thing, and spirit doesn't have body, which disintegrates and decays, so it is simple and it continues to survive after bodily death. So that seems to be a universal belief from the beginning of mankind. But as you had mentioned, or as you didn't mention, but I'll mention, many of those ancient beliefs in this afterlife was a sort of shadowy existence, kind of a depressing existence, where these shadow figures, would you can almost hear them moaning. It was almost like a half-dead kind of existence in the quote-unquote underworld that was seen in places like Hades and Sheol.
Well, that's right. There wasn't the Christian or post-Christian idea of there sort of being this joyful place, if you will. For example, even in the Norse mythology, which would be considered post-Christian, unlike the Greek pantheon, which is pre-Christian, there they have this idea of Valhalla, which is very interesting. So the Valhalla is sort of like this good place for the dead, even though they had their general place itself.
Yeah, well, you have a little of that too with the Jews, with Abraham's bosom.
Yes,
as spoken about in the New Testament.
Rock my soul to the bosom of Abraham. Rock my soul.
These disembodied souls go to Sheol, but there are two parts of Sheol. One is more for the souls of the just, waiting for the Messiah Savior, and the others were souls of the unjust, and they were more in a worse place. But when Christianity came, the ultimate test was now made clear. And what I mean by that is that pre-Christians had a more fuzzy view of to choose good or evil. But Christians had the incarnate God. God came down, took on a human nature, showed us what a human being is, how to live, and what it means to be in right relationship with God. And now the choice is much clearer, I think, for humanity. You either choose God, which is heaven, or you reject God, which is hell. Heaven is infinitely better than places like Sheol and Hades. Hell seems to be infinitely worse than those places. You know what I mean? So that the choices become clearer, but the consequence are the choices, the objects of the choices themselves become more extreme, if you will.
Oh, yes, I would completely agree.
To be ultimate happiness or ultimate misery.
Ultimate misery,
heaven,
despair.
Heaven or hell. We'll get into that a lot more when we come back from this break. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. I'm Paul Morano, as usual. My guest this week, Mr. John Tudorus. We'll be right back. We're back. We is back. Glad you could join us. Beneath the Surface, WCAP. Paul Morano, along with my guest John Tudorus, talking about heaven. What is it? How do you get there? John, during the break, you had mentioned that yesterday we began a new liturgical season called Lent. Excuse me, we're in Advent.
Well,
why don't you tell us a little bit about that and how that relates to our topic tonight?
Well, that's actually the Lent part is actually what Advent used to be known more as. It was commonly called Little Lent. Right, because as far as Christianity goes, for those who aren't aware, there's two general penitential seasons.
Now, tell people what that means.
And what that basically means is think of it as a training, right, for a sport. So you have an end goal. Mm-hmm. And so you do a little training for that. So in the case of Christians, these training periods or these penitential periods are commonly associated with a little extra prayer, fasting, almsgiving, and those are common characteristics that are associated with it. Lent is a little longer and is a little more formal right now, at least in what we call the Latin Rite Church or the Western Church.
Yeah, and the notion is that you're preparing for something that comes at the end of these seasons.
Exactly. So
right?
in the case of Advent, of course, the end of Advent, we have Christmas.
Yes.
And so we remember, actually, the birth of Christ.
Yes.
But one reason why we actually look back towards the birth of Christ is actually so that we can look forward to the second coming of Christ and prepare for that. And so that's really, so the second coming of God, and of course, you know, really what is that? And that's God And the whole world really, Jesus coming a second time, the whole world really being transformed.
Yeah, okay, wait, well, let's delve into beneath the surface as to what you're saying here. So, you believe, and so has Western civilization all the way up until recently, believe that the invisible, almighty creator of the universe, who created everything that there is out of nothing, became a part of his creation.
Yes.
He chose to. It's sort of like an author who writes himself into his own novel.
That's a good analogy.
A painter who paints himself into his own picture.
Just like Norman Rockwell.
So God himself came down from heaven, took on a human nature, became a part of his own creation, inasmuch as he was both God and man at the same time, two natures, one person, one divine person, in order to save us from sin. And of course, this is what Christianity is centered around. But this, what a moment that must have radically, radically beyond imagination transformed the universe, that God himself became a part of it.
Well, it, absolutely. I mean, it's very easy to dismiss as a single point in history, something that just happens. But you're right, when you think of the actual magnitude of it, that the God who is everything, the only necessary being, who is pure spirit, decides to take on matter, which is not part of his nature, but he decides to do so for a very specific purpose, which is to allow his creation, which was created for the intended purpose of being adopted
in union
with him,
which
rejected him, but still,
look, time out. This is good stuff. So his creation, not just his creation, rejected him. What was there a spokesman for this creation?
Adam.
So man, well, Adam is another name for man, or earth man, is or was the spokesman for all of creation. The entire universe was sort of personified in this creature called a human being, who was given a choice because he is personal. Persons choose. They freely choose, either love or not love. So in a sense, Adam spoke for the universe in saying yes or no to God. If he said yes, the universe would have been transformed with divine life in a way that we can't understand, which will occur, right, on when Christ comes back again.
The second coming.
In the transformation of the universe will happen then.
Yes. Now here's the real kicker.
But between the first coming and the second coming, or between Adam and the second coming, a whole lot of sin got in the way, didn't it?
Yes. Oh, yes, it did. And it really started from the first sin, which at first glance can seem very innocent and not that big a deal. What does it mean to eat a piece of fruit? Well, of course, you can also think of it this way, is those whom much is given, much is expected, right? So that even something that seems very small can actually be immensely huge as far as its magnitude. So if you have someone with a natural, perfect knowledge, so right now, for example, science says we only use a small fraction of our brain power, our mental capacity.
And you got to wonder if that would have been the case had original sin not occurred.
Right.
That's
right. And then, of course, we also think of our physical capacity. For example, we only use a certain portion of our strength, our capabilities, and all these things. It's assumed that Adam, and consequently Eve as well, too, would have had these perfect intellects, natural perfect intellects.
And all their progeny.
And all their progeny as well, too, from that common parentage. And so when in that perfection of intellect, not in the same way that angelic might have a perfect intellect, but certainly far greater than ours, when they say no and they give in to their lower passions and appetites rather than letting their will rule over, which they knew better of, they ate the fruit and reap the consequences.
It was a huge sin. Because, like you said, they didn't have inner turmoil like we do, or inner disordered desires, or what theologians call concupiscence. So their sin was a sin of pride. It was a direct challenge to their creator. I do not want to serve is sort of what they were saying.
Yes, not so much perhaps the direct way that Satan would have, but certainly enough that they say, I want to know good and evil.
But it was the devil in the form of a serpent that told them, hey, if you eat from this forbidden fruit, you will not die. You will be like gods who know good and evil.
Well, and the funny thing is that in itself is actually pale in comparison to what God actually intended to actually invite them into union. So not just gods as in like some Greek pantheon where you'll be like others, but rather will they actually enjoy this union with the one true all-powerful God, which far surpasses any of those other pantheons of gods.
True. What they gave up was it was immense, but what they thought they were getting was, hey, I can create my own reality. I can create my own morality if I don't have to listen to God. I can do my own thing.
Well, sounds a lot like what's going on. Sounds
like modernism. But the serpents, you know, made this very attractive to them, and they fell to it. And of course, the rest is literally history. But the first coming was for purposes of taking on a human nature to lead humanity back to God, right?
Yes.
Okay, and so Advent remembers the first coming and its purpose, to be led by Christ back to God.
God came to die in order that we might live.
And during the Advent season, we not only remember the first coming, but we anticipate and look forward to the second coming.
Yes.
Want to elaborate a little bit about what that is and how that relates to heaven?
Well, so in the second coming itself is really the culmination, what's a good word? We'll just use culmination of what the heavenly life would be like for people. So if someone were to die now, before the second coming, there'll be a disembodied soul. And if they are saved, and let's say they are all cleansed out in purgatory, they're up in heaven, they have a natural, perfect happiness according to their capacity as disembodied souls. But they are still not yet complete.
Yeah, so death is, in a sense, an unnatural state of incompletion for the human being.
It is.
We're not meant to be just spirits like angels.
That's correct. Right. We are spirit-matter composite. And so that which is missing ultimately desires to be fulfilled in completion. I forget the passage and where it is, but there's this part in Scripture where it talks about all of creation groaning for the coming of God.
Yes.
And so even our creation, our being, desires that completeness.
And would you say that the souls that are in heaven and in hell also desire that completeness right now?
In a certain sense, yes. See, even the damned, because their nature is still to be complete, even if they've rejected God. So at least in the natural sense, there is a certain...
So then, as Aquinas would say, you can't really call somebody who's in heaven or hell right now a human person or a human being. You'd really have to call them a human soul. Because soul and body together is what makes a real human being.
I think you could say that they are still a human person. The soul is the first principle of the body. So the person, for example, could exist.
But are they a human being?
In the fullness of being, no, they are not. Because their being is both.
So there's something in the human being that survives, but they're not a human being, since human beings are body-soul composites by definition.
Correct. Okay. Not in the fullest sense. They're incomplete. They're disembodied souls at that point.
Okay, so then disembodied souls after death anticipate the second coming of Christ.
Yes.
So that everything will be complete and finished. This redemption, this buying back, this whole exercise of, I guess the whole redemption process, which happened after Adam and will cease to happen when Christ comes back again. So in a sense, all creation will be at peace for the first time since the first moment of man's creation.
Yes, I would definitely say so.
Because things will be made perfect, will be made right.
I would say yes. Now, what that is, that, of course, is another question. Because really, our sense experience. Our all knowledge has its roots in our sense experience in the world.
But everybody seeks perfect justice.
We do.
And everybody, it's really fascinating how it's universal that most people love movies, stories, novels that end with "and they lived happily ever after." Like, you don't get that. You don't get that in this life. Where does this desire of the human heart to live happily ever after, where does it come from, and how is it satiated?
I think it's innate to our nature.
And therefore, if you don't find it in this earthly life, where do you get it?
Well, hopefully in the next. Hopefully in the next. That's the thing. And of course, again...
In other words, every heart anticipates and hopes for heaven.
Naturally, we would. And then, of course, what really needs to happen is that our will, our whole being, has to follow that in the right direction.
And that's why Christ came to the earth the first time, to tell us and show us the direction.
Yes. So he provides the example.
Yeah.
He has sound wisdom teaching.
Yes.
First, and then of course he follows through, and he allows himself to be sacrificed.
So, and he showed us the way, but that's the secondary part. The primary part is that he sent us his spirit so that we can be divinized, in order that we can live the truth. Because we can't, in our fallen nature, live the truth that he showed us without divine grace.
I would say that's very fair to say. Without assistance, left to our own devices, we would fail each and every time.
So he came to show us the way, and then to die on the cross in order to send us his spirit so that we can be filled with divine life in order to truly follow him the right way. It's sort of like saying, I want you to walk over Mount McKinley, and I want you to do it by tomorrow. If I don't give you the means to do it, you know how to do it, but there's no way you can. So then would you say Christ shows us the way and gives us the means?
Absolutely.
Not just one or the other.
Absolutely. The showing the way, of course, we see an example of his teaching. The means, as you also know, he gave us the spirit. And how is that most perfectly communicated? By the ordinary means, is what we call the sacraments. And that's something that you will see in the fullness in both the East and the West. So in your Latin Rite Church, for example, as well as a lot of your Eastern churches, your Orthodox will have it. For example, baptism. So baptism is the, in a certain sense, the most important of the sacraments, in so much as that without it, the others are not possible. Mm. And it's so powerful that it actually can restore people at that very moment to a union with God, in as much as is possible in this life.
Well, I mean, baptism restores that union, gives us the means, or the spiritual strength, but there's still that desert in front of us.
Yes, there is.
The thing we call life.
Very few people die immediately after baptism.
Right. So our consistency or perseverance in that relationship with God is really how you get to heaven, isn't it?
It is, and that's of course comes to the virtues. So as mentioned earlier, the choices, the decisions that we make in this life, ultimately point us towards where our ultimate trajectory is. Now, can people, of course, change at the last minute? It's possible, but quite frankly, our human nature says it's not likely, left to our own devices. So that's why, if one, for example, pursues a virtuous path rather than one full of vice, then those virtues predispose that person towards a heavenly destiny.
So then it's important with every... It really doesn't make any sense to do anything or to choose anything, even get out of bed in the morning, if you don't know the end for which you are living. So in other words, every choice needs to be for, or at least the trajectory should be towards, going closer to that particular end. But if you don't know the end, where are you going in life?
It would certainly be very aimless, I would say.
Very aimless.
And lost.
Yeah. And you would say that every human person doesn't have their own end, we all have a common end.
Yes, we do.
And that common end is what?
Heaven. Heaven is the common end which we are destined for by our nature. Now, whether or not we get there, that is another story.
That has to do with our choices?
Yes.
I need to choose to listen to that music and take one more break. But when we get back, within a moment, we will experience the crescendo of Beneath the Surface tonight. My guest, John Tudoris, Paul Morano, here with my producer, Cindy Annis. Be back right after this break. No, 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 no. 978-454-4980, our phone number. Thanks for joining us again here till 11 o'clock. Paul Morano, John Tudoris, Beneath the Surface tonight here at WCAP. Talking about heaven. Yep. Talking about heaven. What is it? How do you get there? And, John, Scripture says that the road is narrow.
Yes.
Does
very.
It not?
Yes, it does. The road is narrow. To heaven, the road to perdition, a.k.a. H-E double hockey sticks, also known as hell, is wide, and many take it.
The road is wide, and many take it. Why?
It's easy, actually.
Yeah?
It's
sort of default. If you don't think about it or persevere, you just sort of go along with the culture. You'll probably end up there.
Pretty much. I recall this little blurb from G.K. Chesterton, who said, "Only dead bodies flow downstream." And so, of course, it takes a live person to swim against the stream.
Yes, it does. A live human being that makes choices and that doesn't just go with the flow.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I know at the beginning of Christianity, the first few centuries, seemed like most people thought, well, most Christians, most followers, disciples, thought that most of the world went to hell. It seems like in modern times, even within the church, that has kind of flipped. The feeling is that most people go to heaven. Do you think that the reality is somewhere in between, or what do you think?
That's an excellent question. I would say my own personal opinion is it's actually very dangerous to say if most are in one or the other.
Yeah.
So even though...
That's a great answer, by the way.
Right. Yeah. And the reason why is even though Scripture, if taken at face value, as far as, for example, the road is wide, many go it, versus for perdition, and for heaven, it's a very narrow path and few take it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that only...
Yeah.
Those go to heaven. Now, of course, we reap the rewards of our own choices.
And Jesus said that my yoke is easy, my burden light. But he continually warns us to stay awake. So I think that's a trick behind it.
It is.
Spiritually, emotionally, intellectually, stay awake. Don't allow yourself to be swept up by the world.
And I would say if we take everything just at immediate face value, right?
Mm.
So, for example, if we say, okay, God came to this earth, He established one church, it's necessary for you to be in that church and to essentially what we say die in a state of grace in order to enter into heaven, right? So basically, dying in a state of grace just means dying desiring to be with God and not to be in hell. And so if we were to just take all that on face value and say, okay, well, let's look at the numbers in the world. All right, how many are Christian? How many are actually practicing,
right,
etc.? We would actually say that most, if we stop right there, go to hell,
right,
not heaven.
Right.
Right off the bat.
Yep.
Now, the other part, and this is where I put in the caveat, is one is we don't know the nature of people's souls the way God do. We can't see their intellect, their mind. We don't actually have the capacity for God's mercy, too.
Mm.
As far as, so if there's any which way that this person can be saved, he will do it. He will do it. Now, if we still reject him, that is on us. So
God, I mean, even the church teaches that any person, Catholic or not, Christian or not, any person who genuinely lives by the dictates of their conscience, who seeks what is true and good, and loves what he understands, he or she understands to be the divine, that person has a chance for eternal life.
They do. Now, of course,
if their heart is open to this divine life that we talked about
correct.
Earlier, which is called grace.
Exactly.
Grace is the bottom line here, isn't it?
And there has to be a certain intellectual honesty, too, right? So if someone, for example, says, oh, I want to do good, or what have you, but they're willfully ignorant, for example. So there's this term, invincible ignorance.
Yes.
Which basically means that this person really just didn't actually have that chance, for example. But if someone has that opportunity and refuses, they're actually responsible for that lack of knowledge.
So in other words, Christ came to the world to establish a church.
Yes.
Anyone who dwells in that church and dies in a state of grace will be saved. However, because of invincible ignorance, there are a lot of people who either never heard of Catholicism or heard of it in a very faulty way. Somebody or somebody's presented Catholicism to them in a very un-Catholic way, and they have a misunderstanding of it, perhaps. These people might be acting, remaining outside of the church through no fault of their own. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
It's possible. The other thing to keep in mind and is that there are many who would say that invincible ignorance is not as easy to come by as some may think. Because, I mean, if we have at least some formation of reason in, for example, we can say, boy, you know, that looks like it might be true, but if I'm avoiding that, I'm responsible for that.
So you're saying, and this is very important, there's a big difference here between voluntary and involuntary ignorance.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah. I might be ignorant that the church is the way to salvation that Christ established. But is that ignorance voluntary? In other words, I'm too comfortable where I am to do anything about it. That's voluntary ignorance, so I don't want to hear about it.
Oh, sure.
But involuntary ignorance is somebody who, say, grew up in a situation and was... Well, why don't you give me an example of involuntary or invincible ignorance?
Well, we'll use a clear-cut example if I'm over in some... you know, tribe in South America, Africa, and of course, at this point, at some point, we would say some degree of Christianity has been exposed, even these tribes.
Right.
But let's just assume there wasn't. They're completely cut off from the world, but they have this certain natural sense of I'm doing right by my fellow man. For example, I practice virtue. I don't steal. Right. I take care of my family, etc., and do all these good natural things that are good. I look out for my tribe. I'm even generous to those who are not in my tribe because I see people in need. And they haven't had a chance to understand, for example, that God came and desires for them to be in heaven in that fullness. God, in his perfect mercy and perfect knowledge of all things about us, even not just as people in general, but as persons, as individuals, will see if there's any way that this person can be saved to be in union with him, because he knows and he can read their heart to the finest degree.
So, Christ came down to establish the Noah's Ark of the world so that we can get through the deluge to the other side, which is heaven, to use an analogy.
Yes.
Okay. Those who are not on the ark may be saved by lifeboats. If through no fault of their own, they didn't know about the ark, they didn't know that it was what God sent them to be saved.
Yes, and one of the keys on that...
But it's not as easy.
No, in fact, it's much more difficult. And that's why I say, one reason why I say it's very important to not to presume invincible ignorance at all.
Okay.
So to recognize that it's there, but if one presumes that, and inevitably you would be putting in other people in danger and not just ourselves. And it's somewhat of a, I have to be honest, it's a lazy way to go about it, to say,
sure.
Oh, they're probably, it's better that they remain invincibly ignorant. There's a greater chance they'll get to heaven. Au contraire, no.
Yeah.
That there's actually a greater chance that they won't make it, and because we operate in that lazy way, there's a greater chance that we ourselves will not make it because we are not fulfilling a certain responsibility to do good towards others.
Yes.
Which is communicate the truth.
Yes, the fullness of the truth, so it's easier for them to attain salvation.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Very politically incorrect, but we shouldn't care about that.
Hugely politically incorrect.
Okay.
I completely agree, but
yeah.
Much very necessary, and politically correct yeah. can go stuff it.
The virtue of courage seems to be missing today, or at least very low on... you don't see it that often in a time... that you really, really need courage, because the message of salvation is being completely distorted by the media and academia in ways that are unprecedented.
I would completely agree with you on that. The list is actually too numerous to go over in the show.
Of course. A whole nother show for that.
Yes.
Notice how I said a whole nother? Isn't it a whole other?
Another is more another. Of a with an apostrophe.
Yeah. All right. 978-454-4980 if you want to get involved in our conversation. We only have 6 minutes left. All right, so John, it is the natural, or I would say the natural or supernatural end of the human person and to be fulfilled in the beatific vision after this life in heaven. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, so that is the end to which all of our actions here on earth should be pointed to.
Yes.
Okay. I guess I'll go right to the opening, the question that that the show is named after, and that is, what is heaven?
So heaven, union with God, which I think we mentioned. So, but what does that mean, union with God? So that is our nature is infused with divine life. So it's not just a natural life, which we have right now, but it, what we would say, is a supernatural life.
But you
life.
Say you say that being in the state of grace, when we're here on earth, we can be infused with supernatural life.
To a degree.
Okay, to a degree. That's the trick in understanding this.
Exactly.
So we're there's always a part of us that is not in full union with God here on earth.
That is correct. We would say that now here on earth, we are still filled with potential or potency. Whereas
even in the state of grace,
state of grace. Whereas in heaven, if we are in heaven, we'd say we are fully actualized. At least as far as there's no more potential there.
No more potential for fulfilling our being.
Exactly. We however big our cup got, that's it. It's capped off right there, but it is filled to the brim and overflowing.
Let me read you something from the book of Revelation, chapter 21, verse 4, because this is the Apostle John in his vision. It seems to me he's speaking about heaven here when he says, I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, God's dwellings with the human race. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will always be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eye, and there shall be no more death or mourning, wailing or pain, for the old order has passed away.
That's right. No death.
That's a beautiful passage, isn't it?
No suffering. Very beautiful.
Death,
so no death,
mourning.
No suffering, no need for mourning at all.
The old order, which is filled with suffering, mourning, and pain, which we're living now, will have passed away.
Completely gone.
That order of life, which is filled with sin, ever since mankind ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he introduced evil into the world, and that order, which has been around for many, 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 many centuries, will have been passed away, and there will be nothing impeding the very life of God for us in our souls, in our bodies, which is really that which fulfills us.
Yes, there will be really nothing left. So if there's no suffering, there's no death, really what is there to mourn? I mean, why do people mourn at all? Oh, I got hurt. Oh,
yeah.
My friend died. My dog died.
Something is missing in their life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There won't
nothing,
be anything missing at all.
Nothing will be incomplete. Emotionally, physically, nothing. Spiritually?
That's correct. And of course, as far as... to continue on that, so
yeah.
It's not just the disembodied soul
right.
and sort of this temporary spot, if you will. where really the fullness of heaven is, again, going back to Revelation, where he talks about heaven and earth kissing,
yes,
if you will.
So when Christ comes back again, bodies will be raised.
Yes.
The universe will be transformed, and both in ways that we can't imagine. They'd be so beautiful and so wonderful. And sin will be completely eradicated, and there'll be nothing but happiness and joy. Yes?
That's a good place to be. Desire it.
Yeah. See? And that's what God always wanted for us.
Yeah.
All we have to, you know, if we don't say no to him with our lives, then we'll be with him.
Absolutely. And when we fall short, ask for mercy, always.
Sacrament of confession.
It's a great place to be.
Thank you, Mr. John Tudorus. Good show. Good way to end it, and upbeat, hopeful.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Heaven is very hopeful.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Heaven. Beneath the surface. Actually, it'll be way above the surface. Thanks for listening to us tonight. See you again next week. Paul Morano, my guest, John Tudorus. Have a great week. And Cindy's Vinyl Vault coming.
I feel silly trying to make up prayers myself. My mind starts to wander as I'm speaking to God. I just don't have time to pray. Do you recognize yourself in any of these statements? If so, we have a book for you. In Pray Fully, best-selling authors Michelle Fanley and Emily Jaminet share the rewards and frustrations of their own prayer journeys to create a practical guide that combines testimonies, tips, and journaling space to help you spend quality time with God. Whether you want to learn how to pray aloud in a group or stop your mind from wandering during prayer, Fanley and Jaminet have practical advice and the real-life experience to help you overcome obstacles to everyday prayer. Head over to AveMariaPress.com and use code LEARN2PRAY, that's LEARN2PRAY, to get 20% off your copy today. Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small batch artisan coffee using top-tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic-themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/Breadbox Media. Experience coffee like never before.